Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 238, featuring Matt Wallen, who is a professor at Virginia's Commonwealth University School of Arts. A really cool guy. And Kristen helped me get him as a guest during SIGGRAPH. And Kristen is joining me for the podcast intro. Hi, Kristen.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
You were just mentioning the fact that you thought that he was a super nice guy and you wish you had met him, right?
Yes, I really wish I did.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a super, super cool guy. I have actually known him for many years, but never actually met him physically until just before we did the podcast.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah,
awesome.
Yeah, he's really nice. He actually is also, besides being a professor, he's also a co-host of the VFX Show, which is another podcast that's part of the FX Guide network. And the other host, of course, is Mike Seymour. So I've heard Mike and Matt talk about movies for quite a while. And also want to do a shout out to Mike Seymour, who just got his PhD. So congratulations, Mike, on that amazing accomplishment. And I know that he had used part of the Wiki Human Data to help him with his PhD. So I'm really excited that he was able to do that. All right. So, Kristen, great conversation with Matt, by the way. He's a really amazing person. Besides him being a professor and a podcast host, he was at ILM for many years. He worked on many different movies and has some really great stories about the cool stuff that he's done in the industry. So really cool to hear from a true veteran of the industry, which is great. We do have some announcements. So we have something going on special on Cloud. Do you know what's going on in Cloud?
Oh, I think I do.
Yeah. All right, what's going on?
All right, Chaos Cloud sign up. You can sign up for a trial and get 20 free credits. And if you do this before August 30th, you will be entered into a lottery to win 200 extra credits.
That's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. So where can people find out about this?
So if you go to chaosgroup.com/cloud, you'll be able to find all this out.
All right. Really cool. So if you guys are interested in trying Cloud out, go there and try out the 20 extra credits, but you also have a chance to win 200 extra credits, but you must do it before August 30th. Again, that is chaosgroup.com/cloud. Also, V-Ray for Houdini is out. We've mentioned it for the last couple of weeks, but I want to make sure you guys know about it. So go to chaosgroup.com, check it out for V-Ray for Houdini, and you can get a free trial if you'd like to try it out also. I think it's a 30-day trial. A 30-day trial on all our stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Right, Kristen?
I think so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, there's an event happening this week that we're involved with. Which one is that?
That is D2, which is in Vienna.
Yes. And it's a big ArcVis conference. And what days is it happening?
It will happen August 23rd and 24th.
Yes. Perfect. Fabio and Jason are, of course, the two people that we know the most that are involved in that, and they're really cool. Very excited to be part of D2. Unfortunately, I will not be going to D2 this year, but there's definitely going to be Chaos Group representation there, which is really cool. And we have a roundup. How was your SIGGRAPH? This was your first SIGGRAPH, wasn't it?
It was. It was really fun. I liked it.
Yeah?
Yeah. I'm excited for next year because I'll have to go check out so much more. But yes. Yeah. It was really fun.
It's my 22nd SIGGRAPH, so
crazy.
So I've done quite a few.
Yeah.
But it's really cool that you're able to go to SIGGRAPH, mm-hmm, and be part of it. We have some write-ups about it that are both Total Chaos. So we have Total Chaos in Sofia and Total Chaos at SIGGRAPH. And those where can people get those write-ups?
So if you go to chaosgroup.com/blog, you'll be able to find all of that there.
Right. Perfect. Mm-hmm. And this includes actually a lot of the talks that happened at Total Chaos in Sofia. So there's a lot of stuff that you guys can watch. Really great talks there. And a big write-up about everything that happened at SIGGRAPH. And I think there's two or three talks that happened there, including Vlado and Renderland talk, which is really interesting. Mm-hmm. And a big thing about Lavina. Lavina was kind of like made a big splash at SIGGRAPH this year again. So really cool to see that technology. Mm-hmm. All right, guys. Thank you so much, Kristen.
Thank you.
And hopefully you guys will enjoy this great episode with Matt Wallen.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fernell.
Well, because if I didn't have the GorillaPod, the mic would be on the table.
Yeah, and then any noise on the table.
Yeah. This was a whole, I don't know. It's very garagey, right?
Well, it's cool. It's appropriate. That's the title of the show.
Yeah, that's the title of the show.
Which I have to say, you have amassed quite a collection now of really good interviews.
Well, thank you.
I went back and I've listened to now almost every single one of them. I think there's a few I haven't, but it's pretty good. Some of them are not really in my wheelhouse, but some of them are really fascinating. It's good.
Well, I really appreciate that because I have worked hard to sort of trying to make it interesting while still keeping the podcast very casual.
You know? Well, but sometimes you do ones that are really technical too.
I did.
And some of the really technical ones I think go a little beyond my realm of, understanding.
Right.
But I kind of dig it. Because I kind of know what they're talking about, but I don't know the math or something.
Right. Well, one, for example, the one that just came out today with X-Ray. Do you know X-Ray? He's an old legendary visual effects guy from DD, et cetera. And he and I talk about his history as, being one of the first DD employees, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh,
but
really?
Then we suddenly got into this big side conversation about color space and
I just was watching this denoiser, machine learning denoiser thing that they were talking about. And then they folded into another conversation. I can't remember the guy's name now. But he had written a 3D point cloud-based color mapping tool.
Yeah.
Where you were able to then, basically use... they built a little tool in Maya where you could use soft selection.
Uh-huh.
And a lattice and start to cull and move around colors and match these 3D point cloud color spaces to match two different images. And
wow.
It was really cool, but I have to say it's kind of devastating because it's exactly like a tool that I've been working on for the last couple of years. Only
really?
Theirs is so much better. Just a more sophisticated engineering path.
Right.
They arrived at something
What's a tool you've been working on?
With a couple colleagues from the university where I teach, we started with one guy from physics and then another guy from my program who's since retired. Mm-hmm. Actually, they're both retired, which is kind of funny. But we were looking at teaching color theory to students.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things a lot of the students aren't really great at is understanding color and color spaces.
It's very hard to understand, actually.
Yeah, so we thought of making a three-dimensional point cloud of color spaces, which there's several examples of that out there.
Yeah.
But then setting it so you could create variable resolutions of the model.
Mm-hmm.
You could do Booleans of different color models and see where they overlap and where they have differences, how some go far beyond. We made a theoretical color model of human color gamut,
average what you can see,
vision.
Visual color, right?
Yeah, and put pigment models in there. So we had the Gamblin model. We got their Gamblin paints.
Mm-hmm.
And why am I drawing a blank? Who's the, the colored pencils with their weird system?
Prismacolor?
Not Prisma, but...
Pantone.
Pantone, yeah.
Yeah,
with their ridiculous color system.
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense.
Everything's copyrighted.
Yeah, totally. It was cool, but these guys were doing mostly visual effects stuff, but I started thinking, when he was demoing what they were doing, the things that we've been looking at are, machine vision stuff and thinking about, medical imaging.
Mm-hmm.
And how you could use color vision to look at, images from surgeries or stuff, where they already do that and they do analysis, but they're doing it they're visually looking at it.
Right.
But you could isolate for specific hues and specific, color subsets, and then quantify how many times does it occur in a given image at a set resolution and come up with, ways that you could automate a lot of those processes visually, at least get enough hits that you could train something so that it would know when you were looking at something that needed to be looked at more closely by a human.
What's ironic is that you were just telling me how like something is too technical for you, but somehow that is very technical, but I guess again,
well, I couldn't,
totally in your wheelhouse,
I
right?
couldn't make it. Like, I can't make the tool,
yeah,
but I can. But I can talk about like concepts, I think.
Sure. With,
like, I can do sort of like that level of thinking, but the like actual like writing of the code and stuff, yep. the development of the program is a little bit, that would be a struggle for me, which is why we would stall. Like, we'd get these PhD students to come from the School of Engineering over to right. our program, and they would help us, and then they would graduate, and they'd be like, I'm out of here, you know, I got a job at Google or whatever,
right.
and
yeah,
they were
yeah.
gone. So, yeah.
Well, it's interesting. So, you know, one of the things that has happened to me because of the podcast that I do is that suddenly I'm walking around places like SIGGRAPH and people recognize my laugh. And it's like, oh, are you the guy from CG Garage, right? And I thought it was always kind of funny. Hearing your voice, I feel the same thing because I've never met you in person.
Right.
I've only known your voice, and I've heard your voice many, many times on the VFX show,
yeah.
right? Which is Yoohoo and Mike Seymour. And it's so funny to hear your voice. It's like, wow. I knew I was going to experience that, where I'm going to see you in person, and it's like, wow, what is that like? Because I think, you know, you and I have talked over a couple of things, mm-hmm. But I've always really enjoyed your insight into that show and what you do. But I think people need to know a little bit about your history and where does that come from? Because obviously you've been doing this for a long time.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I realize now, like I'm one of the old guys.
Which yeah.
is so weird to me.
Ditto.
Like, it's so weird. I still yeah. feel like I'm one of the young upstart, but like I come to SIGGRAPH now and I'm just like, oh, wow. Like all these people are getting up and talking and they're saying, I got really into visual effects on when I saw my first Harry Potter movie. And I'm like, what?
I know, because we got into it from 2001 or something, right?
Yeah, totally. Well, yeah. For me, like I grew up, I was born here and
in LA?
At the Hospital of the Good Samaritan, which
really?
I think is not far from here.
Okay.
And then my family, when I was like two or something, just moved down what we used to call behind the Orange Curtain.
Right, in Orange County.
In beautiful Orange County, California. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in Santa Ana.
Mm-hmm.
And like every visual effects person that you talk to that's kind of our age, like mm-hmm. for me it was Star Wars.
Yep, a lot of people were Star Wars.
And
yeah.
just seeing that as a kid, like it was... It was so, I mean, it, you know, whatever, all the cliches. Like, it was just so cool. It was so different than anything that had come before. And
right.
it really was captivating. It really was building a world, constructing a really rich narrative. And the visual effects were really cool. I mean, and even, I was 7, I think, when it came out. I think mm-hmm. we're, like, pretty close to the
we're
same
very
age.
Close, yeah.
I think I might
6.
Be 1 year older than
yeah.
you.
Yeah. So you're 70, I'm 71. So.
Yeah.
Totally. Okay.
So... I mean, it was, like, I was totally the perfect age for that mm-hmm. movie, and I got really into, like, you know, at the time, like, you'd go to the supermarket with, you know, mom or dad, and, like, you'd be standing in line, there'd be an article, and there'd be a People magazine with C-3PO on the cover, mm-hmm. or there'd be, you know, they had a thing, I think it was called the Star Wars album, but it
right.
wasn't the record album, it was, like a movie book, you know,
yeah,
and
yeah.
it was, like, sort of, like, all these
yes.
pictures and stuff, and I still have my copy of that, and I got really into looking through all those things, and I loved all the like history of cinema that I didn't know when I was a kid. I was sort of reading that stuff and learning about, you know, Trip to the Moon and
yep.
like all the kind of early sci-fi kind of movies from the silent era, and then all the like 50 science fiction movies, which I didn't know. Oh, sometimes you'd see them like on KTLA, Channel 5 in the
sure.
summertime
yep.
or something.
Yep.
But I just got really into that, and that one of the things I always loved when I was a kid was anytime you'd see any of the books that showed the models. So there are all those great pictures of like
maquettes and stuff, right?
Or like Grant McCune and some of the models that they built, mm-hmm. or what was his name, Cantwell, Colin Cantwell, I think,
mm-hmm.
and some of those like you know TIE fighters and pictures of Dennis Muren, you know, mm-hmm. like in front of a blue screen and
yep.
stuff, or. And those pictures were so cool because as a kid, like, I just wanted to play with toys.
Right.
And I was like, well, those are the coolest toys.
And these guys
and they're not the toys. Those are actually the things in the movie, right?
Right. And people are using them and they're being paid money to play with toys.
Yeah. And I didn't know that I had that cognitive, like, understanding as a kid, but it was something that I was always, like the mystery of like the blue, the bright blue screen and the blue sort of cylinder and yes. the camera and the crane that was controlled by like a computer, you know. Right. I think those images were things that like really, I just looked at them for hours as a kid, and it was just stuff that stuck in my brain.
Uh-huh.
And so I think without thinking about visual effects, I was always interested in filmmaking. But the visual effects component was always something I think that was like deeply embedded in my
yeah.
cranium.
So what allowed you to make that transition? What did you do to make that transition?
I mean, I did what a lot of kids did. I mean, I built like tons of like helicopter and airplane models and stuff as yep. a kid, and would like light them on fire, and I would take pictures of them while they were burning. I didn't have a video camera
really?
Or a movie camera or anything, but I loved like, you know, seeing if I could get a really, I had one cool picture of a Huey helicopter that I built and like really poorly painted, you know, mm-hmm. and I have one picture where there's a flame coming off it that looks like a mushroom cloud kind of, and I'm like, that one's so cool, it looks like it's really exploding. And I was really into that kind of stuff as a kid. And then I can't remember what year it came out. It might have been when I was in high school, the big ILM coffee table book, the first one.
Uh-huh.
I think that came out in like 86, maybe?
Really?
Okay. 87. Okay. I could be wrong about that, but I seem to remember sure. having that fairly early on and reading that cover to cover. And then when it came time to go to college, I didn't have like a super awesome grade point average. Like I wasn't going to be going to Harvard,
you know,
right. yeah. or MIT or anything like that.
Well, you were busy burning up models.
Yeah. And like, and then skateboarding and
sure.
stuff like that. All the kind of Southern California tropes, I
right.
think was kind of things that I was into. And, mm-hmm. and, I was looking at different schools and, I wanted to get away from home, but not like, I didn't know if I wanted to really leave the state. And then San Francisco State University, I thought was cool because it was, it had this real history of protesting, and it was like the first ever like African-American studies program, the first ever women's studies program.
Nice.
And like it had this real radical sensibility to it.
Right.
And they were willing to take me in the school.
Okay,
my not so awesome academic records.
Right.
And plus it was close to Lucasfilm. Lucasfilm's
right.
headquarters was near there. And
yep.
at the time, Francis Ford Coppola's brother, his older brother, August Coppola, was the dean of the School of Creative Arts that the film's program
okay.
was in at the time.
Yeah.
And so I went to school there and studied film and studied basically.
So they had a film program there?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. They had like an experimental documentary and animation program. And then there was the film production core where they were shooting like 16 millimeter movies mm-hmm. with like Nagra, you know, recording, like reel to reel recording mm-hmm. devices, like really ancient equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I think somebody that you just interviewed, I think a woman that was from Europe or something, who's living in Sweden now.
Oh, Sonia.
Sonia, yeah.
She was over in, she went to University of Miami, I think, yeah.
And yeah, she said something that was like, so funny. She said the year she left was the year they built a new building.
Yes,
and
she
exactly
did.
The same thing happened at San Francisco State. The year I left, they built a brand new, like, state-of-the-art facility and got
right.
all this new equipment.
Nice.
But, you know, whatever. But while I was in film school, I made films and learned how to, like, cut like actual physical film. And,
uh-huh.
and I applied for an internship, a summer internship, the summer before my last year of school at LucasArts is what it was called
oh,
at the
right.
time.
Yep, yep, yep.
And in that was Lucas Which Games
was
and
Lucas Games,
Digital
yeah, yeah.
was, I think, another component, or maybe that was pre-Lucas Digital, but it encompassed kind of that whole sub.
But it was not ILM.
ILM was a part of
it. ILM was a part of it, okay.
Arts, I believe. And I was rejected for the paid internship, but
okay.
never one to give up.
Mm-hmm.
I applied again in the fall for an academic internship, which mm-hmm. wasn't paid. And I got an interview, and I went and I interviewed for this position. And this was my last semester of school. I graduated mm-hmm. in December as opposed to
right.
May, like a lot of students do. And I went and I interviewed with this woman, Susan Kelly, mm-hmm. and Kelly Rude. These two women who were working in the art department, and they needed somebody to come and organize the slide archive in the still photography department. And I, you know, like librarian type stuff, yep. basically. And like, I have no qualifications to do that whatsoever. When I went for the interview, I was so nervous. I don't even know that, like, I probably said like two words to them. Like, I was so right. like, you know, freaked out to be there. And later, I got the internship. But later, Susan Kelly, many years later, I remember she had said to me, she's like, oh, I just figured like, well, I mean, he seems like a nice kid, like, mm-hmm. and he doesn't say much. Like, he'll probably be fine working alone, like up in the attic, like with all the slides. She right. was like, you know, let's give him a shot or whatever.
Right.
And that internship wound up essentially turning into a full-time job, right? Like shortly after I graduated.
Okay.
And then I was there for, from 1992 till 99. So
oh, wow.
I was there like right when I first started, they were finishing up the first Jurassic Park movie. Mm-hmm. They were working on that Meteor Man
yes.
movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Fire in the Sky, I think, was the alien.
So, but you weren't storing slides the whole time. How did
no,
you?
No, no. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I was doing slides. And then I met some people in the art department through that job and the people in the still photo department.
Right.
And just as an intern, you know, you're kind of like the...
You do have the freedom to kind of walk around and meet people, right?
Yeah, you could cruise around and sort of see what's going on. Mm-hmm. And when they finally... When I did graduate, and like I think I left for a while and I kind of just goofed off and was living with my roommate in San Francisco and was looking at different jobs. I applied at Colossal Pictures. And uh-huh. There was a thing I think called Red Sky. It was a commercial house there.
Okay, in the Bay Area,
in
right?
In the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And nothing was really panning out. And then I got a job doing as a production assistant on an insurance company commercial that ILM was doing with this producer, Paul Hill.
Okay.
And they needed me to come out really early in the morning to Nicasio, California, like almost out to Point Reyes, kind of.
Okay.
And they drove me out there. And they had a little bobcat backhoe, and they needed me to go, and this is against really early days of computer graphics, so they needed me to take a chain, wrap a chain around the digger part of the backhoe,
yeah.
and then wrap the chain around these metal barbed wire fence posts that right. had been put in cement, and like lift those out of the ground. And so that when they were going to have a shot then of a guy on a horse, like in a, you know, full knight armor, mm-hmm. like riding on this beautiful misty morning ride towards a castle that was going to be a matte painting. And then
okay.
That was my first real job working paid for ILM.
So
was operating a backhoe.
So wait, you're pulling stakes out of the ground? How
using the backhoe. So like I'd whip the chain around the backhoe, right. like the digger part. And then whip the other part of the chain around the metal stake,
yeah.
and then get in the thing and like use the backhoe to pull it up,
yes.
and then it would pull the stake out of the ground. And then I had these big leather gloves, and I was wrapping up the barbed wire. The only thing they didn't remember though is there was nowhere for me to go to the bathroom while I was on this like big farm, and so I was left there to my own devices.
Right,
it was quite an interesting morning.
Yeah, that's all day. Here you are. And have you ever operated a backhoe before?
No, they showed me how to do it. Paul, he's like, all you do is you do this, and you do this. And we did one together. And he's like, you good? And I was like, yeah, I guess so. Right. And he's like, all right, we'll be back shortly after this, like right around the time the sun's coming up. And I'm like, okay.
Wow.
So that was my first like paid job like in the movie business.
Wow.
Yeah.
Not what you expected.
No, but it was fun. I mean, I was super happy to be doing it. I was like, this is really cool. The only thing that was funny was the very last one that I had to pull out of the ground. You know what they did was the guys, when they put it in, they had a bunch of cement left, right? A bunch of quickrete or whatever.
Right.
So they dumped it all in the hole. They were like, we're just going to get rid of it all.
Right.
So the last one was so heavy that when I went to pull it up with the little bobcat, the back of the bobcat started to come off the ground. So,
yeah, and you were terrified that the whole bobcat was
going to tilt over. Like, I was going to like be killed, you know, because this like young, dope, like 22-year-old kid.
And you just learned how to use this thing a few hours before.
Yeah, it was crazy. But then after that, like they didn't have anything for a while. And then a job opening came up and they kept calling back and stuff. And the position was to answer the phones.
Yeah.
And at first, my first reaction was like, "That's beneath me. I'm a filmmaker, you know,
right.
Like, I'm not going to,
sure.
You know, like that's my first gut reaction, I think, at that age, at that time. And they wanted me to commit to doing it for 12 months. Mm-hmm. You had to do it for 1 year.
But to answer end, phones for a year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it involved other stuff, like you would do, like, you know,
photocopies.
Yeah, like stock the copy room and like right. get coffee and stuff and order things from a couple vendors. Right. And it was managed by this really pretty brilliant woman, Paula Karsh, who ran the purchasing department. And right. she was like the ultimate like deal maker. Like she could get people to like bend over backwards to like, you know, cut costs and keep right. the budget down and stuff. And she was kind of the manager of the people that worked the front desk. But I had learned that Patty Blau, who was the head of production, she had also started as the receptionist. That was her first job at ILM,
mm-hmm.
Back in the pre-Empire days, I think. Like, was she started at the very beginning when they first came up north. And Miles Perkins, who was like their PR publicity dude, he had started in that job. And so I'm like, well, okay, this is a good stepping stone. And they said, after a year, if there's any jobs that open up, like, we'll consider you for a position. And while you're here, like, you know, you'll kind of see what's going on. And so I was like, okay. And I started doing that job. And you'd have to page people on this big PA system all around the old San Rafael lot. And so my voice was getting broadcast all over the company. And,
right, as you're paging people.
Yeah. And within like a week, every single person in the company knew my name. And within probably a couple months, I knew everybody's name. I knew everyone's extension. I knew who worked in what department. I knew who reported to who. Producers that would call from LA and directors and stuff, people that would call like looking to talk to somebody, they got to know me. They got to know my name. Like people would come in. I was the face they saw. I had them sign in and stuff. So in a weird way, like
answering the phone is a very powerful position.
It was a cool job. Like I learned so much about how that company operated.
I don't think people realize that.
Yeah. And I totally didn't either until I did it.
Yeah.
But once I did it for a year, I was like, well, this is a cool gig.
Yeah.
And I wound up doing it for a little more than a year. And then after that job sort of came to its denouement or whatever, like it... there was an opportunity to go and start doing rotoscoping and 2D paint mm-hmm. stuff. And at the time, it was on a Silicon Graphics, like an Indigo 2, I think.
Okay.
Using Matador software.
Yes.
I don't know if you ever remember
Matador. Yeah.
Parallax Matador.
Silhouette came after that, I think. But yeah. I remember that Matador, yeah.
And so I did that for probably a year or so. The first show I worked on was... the Rob Reiner movie, The American President. It was Ken Ralston's last show.
Really?
At ILM, I believe. And here with him and Debbie DeNice, who wound up going to Sony. They both went to Sony.
Okay.
And it was just doing rotoscoping and some 2D paint stuff. And then that naturally led into compositing.
Right.
And the cool thing at ILM was like, you know, you'd get up and move around, you'd go to dailies and stuff, and it was really small when I started. There was only, I think, maybe a couple hundred employees when I first started working there. Uh-huh. And by the time I left in 99, there was, I think, over 1,500 employees. So it was like that explosion happened while I was there. And all those kind of techniques and the development of all those, the first, like, sort of, you know, character, like, full-blown character animation mm-hmm. in CG, the first, like, photoreal character animation with like the, I think it was what, Dragon Heart or mm-hmm, whatever, and mm-hmm. With lip sync and, you know, perform, trying to capture a performance.
Right.
And the development, of a lot of those tools was happening at that time. And it was just super exciting. It was such a really, I was still a very young kid, you know, working there, like in my 20s and sort of still kind of developing as a person myself, I mm-hmm. think. But the kinds of things that I was around in that culture, I appreciate it so much more now looking back on it than I probably did at the time. Like I loved working there, but I always sort of felt like there was more I wanted to be doing than I was doing there at the time.
Okay.
I got restless after, you know, those maybe first 5 or 6 years and felt like there was maybe more stuff I could get into.
And so where did that lead you to?
So I guess it must have been like 96. So 95, 96. Mm-hmm. A good friend of mine who was in the editorial, visual effects editorial department there, is this guy Scott Balsarek. He'd gone to AFI. Mm-hmm. And Scott Balsarek was from Pittsburgh, and he came out to California, and he went to AFI, and he was like just totally into filmmaking and really into music. And he knew a lot of people on the East Coast. And he said, oh, hey, you should come with me. There's these movies showing at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, which was pretty new at the time.
Oh, right, right, yeah.
And there's these movies playing by this artist. They look really weird. Like, we should go check them out. They're like 40 minutes long. Mm-hmm. Like, there's two of them. And I was like, oh, I don't really want to go. It sounds really lame. Like, but I was kind of into experimental filmmaking at mm-hmm. SF State. That was a big thing that they
yep.
kind of were always into. And so I went with him and a couple other friends, and we saw Cream Master 4 and Cream Master 1, which were these two experimental short films made by this artist, Matthew Barney.
Okay.
And after the first one that we saw, which was Cream Master 4, where yep. these two motorcycles race around the Isle of Man in opposite directions, one of them's green, and or one of them's yellow and one of them's blue, and they eventually collide and they turn green. And I don't know, it was just really weird, like super bizarre, but cool. It was kind of punk rock. It felt right. kind of anxiety and panic was kind of part of the theme of the story. There was no dialogue or anything.
Right.
But, and it was visually really stunning. It was low budget, but like you could tell it was super ambitious in terms of its cinematic pursuits. And it had some effects in it, really bad ones, but... I was super into it. My friends wanted to leave after the first one. I decided to stay. And in staying, I watched the second film. It was equally really cool and also had some really like videographic kind of stuff in it.
Yeah.
And afterwards, I started doing a bunch of research into the artist. And it turned out he was an American, Matthew Barney. He lived in New York, and he was about my age. And I came across, like, it was pre-Google, right?
Sure.
So I had to back order issues of magazines. So uh-huh. I back ordered an issue of that magazine Art Forum.
Okay, yes.
And we always jokingly now we call it Art For Him. You know, like it's such a cornball magazine. But there was an interview with him, and there were pictures in the magazine of the production of this film, this Cream Master 4, this first film. And the pictures looked a lot like those pictures I saw as a kid of like the making of Star Wars. Like mm-hmm. it had that same resonant vibe.
Something
for me.
Clicked there. Right?
Yeah, I was like, that's really cool. Like I gotta see what that's about. And turned out it was an interview with the artist, and the interview was conducted by this woman, Thirza Goodeve, whose brother was Grant Goodeve, who was on Eight Is Enough, the TV show.
Oh,
he was the
nice.
Older brother.
Yeah,
but it's totally irrelevant. But yeah. But. Thirza had been my senior thesis advisor in film school, which was a totally weird, bizarre coincidence.
Yeah.
So I wrote to her. She didn't remember me, mm-hmm. but she okay. said, "But she said, oh, you should write to him at the gallery in New York. You know, like just write him a letter." So I.
But you got that information from her, though.
That what the gallery was,
right.
yeah. So I went to the. I was still working at ILM, and I went to the copy room. At ILM and took a piece of Industrial Light and Magic letterhead uh-huh. with the magician on it. It was pre the new logo. It was back right. when they used that weird magician thing that yeah. never reduced very well. Like yeah. on business cards, it just looked like a big thumbprint kind
right.
of.
Right. But
and I just wrote a letter to him saying something. I was like so pompous. I said something like, you know, I saw some of your films and you had some very crude computer graphics in them. And I said something about how like at ILM we have more computing power, I think, second only to NASA. You know, like, it was so stupid. And totally over the top. And but I said, I might be able to, we have this independent projects program, which they did, and you could do little projects on the side. And I said, you know, if you ever wanted to do some computer graphics, like, at a kind of higher level for one of your projects, you should give me a call. Like, I'd love to help you out. It'd be really fun. And, you know, we could probably finagle some like late night hours and do something
sure
kind of off book. And 2 weeks after I sent that letter, I was at my desk just sitting there working on whatever show I was working on at the time, and and he said, hey, you know, we're going to Budapest and we want to put ice in the Danube River to make it look like it's frozen, and he's doing a bungee jump off the Lanchet Bridge that connects Buda and Pest, and reenacting this Houdini trick, and he wanted to know if we could paint out the bungee cord and put ice in the river. And I was shocked that he called, and I was like, well, sure, we could do that. And let me see, like, how many shots would it be? Do you know, like, how long it would take? And I got in touch with a producer friend of mine there and a post-production supervisor friend, Dan McNamara and Kim Bromley. And I just kind of picked their brains about, like, how could I do this? And they
right.
said, she said, well, submit a proposal to the general manager, Jim Morris. And mm-hmm. so I submitted a proposal. And they went for it. And we wound up doing this project, like, I got a team of friends together. And we yep. used, I think we did it on the Flame, or their Saber, I think
right.
was the system they called it there, which was like a custom kind of Flame setup that they had.
Yep.
And we did a bunch of stuff for that show, and I got a friend, Rod Bogart, helped write a tool that looked at, because they shot in Budapest, and they shot with NTSC cameras, but they shot on the bridge, and the frequency of the lights to the frequency of the camera were
Does
offset.
Not match. Right.
And so there was this flicker, and like it was in all the shots at night on the bridge.
Right.
And I talked to my friend Rod Bogart, who was one of the guys who developed the OpenEXR mm-hmm. standard and stuff. And he said, yeah, we could probably do something like that. I had worked with him on a Shoah Foundation documentary where he took all these old 16mm or 35mm images from like the
Holocaust survivors,
yeah. but also from like it was more like the ghetto, like the Warsaw ghettos and stuff,
right.
I think. And like, and we did a bunch of like dirt, like scratch removal, where he wrote this amazing tool and I just ran the script basically, but
sure.
where you could sample frames on either side and it would look for like those pixels in that location and try to fill stuff in. I mean, Rod Bogart is a genius.
Mm-hmm.
And his initials are RBG or RGB,
oh,
which is so cool.
Yep.
But he wrote a tool that like would remove this flicker. And so we wound up doing that kind of as a bonus.
Mm-hmm.
And we did the job, and it was really fun, and I got to meet the artist, and it turned out his cinematographer lived in Sausalito, this guy Peter Streetman, who
okay.
became a really good friend, too. And when it was all said and done, I had my producer friend sort of tally up, like, what it would have cost, and, like, you know, sort of like an invoice, and...
fake invoice, because it was all donated.
Because it was all done on the,
right.
on the DL, kind of, and... it came to something like, you know, $400,000 or $500,000 or something like that. And I just sent it to him and I just wrote no charge at the bottom,
mm-hmm.
you know, just because it was kind of pompous, but I kind of maybe a little arrogant, but I sort of felt like, well, it's kind of cool to know what
he
this
needs
stuff
to
is
know
worth.
The value of what he got. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, I think he really appreciated it because like he wound up, he flew me out to New York for the opening mm-hmm. of the show at the Gladstone Gallery. And there was a big party afterwards. I'd never been to anything like that before. And gave me a piece of artwork and stuff, which I have hanging in my house. And it was awesome. It was totally cool. And I was
so
a visual
great.
Effects supervisor, which was something I'd always wanted to do.
Well, isn't it like just taking the initiative is a big deal, though, right? You know, because a lot of people go out there and go, I really wish I could do something, but I never really take the initiative, right? And you were like, okay, regardless of the fact that you were pompous in your thing, like we have more computing power than NASA, whatever.
I was a kid, you know?
Of course, we all were kids, and we've all said asinine things.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, that was enough for it to get his attention, and maybe
yeah.
that's actually a benefit that you actually used those words, because I was like, oh yeah, as opposed to being too humble, and they're like, okay, well, whatever. So take that initiative, do something, and you know. You know what? You're really proud of the fact that you were able to get all these people to do these amazing work for that. And look what you got out of it. You got a great trip to New York. You got an art piece, and you got probably a good friend for a long time, right?
Well, I wound up, yeah. I mean, I basically wound up working with and for Matthew Barney for probably the next 10 years of my
yeah.
career. Like, that yeah. became a whole nother thing
yeah.
that, like, grew, and we did these other much larger scale projects. I had started my own company.
Yeah.
I mean, I did that project, went back to work at
ILM.
ILM. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was still at ILM. I'd never left, but mm-hmm. I went back to work on whatever show I was on. I think I was on like Speed 2 Cruise Control and Twister.
Nice.
And eventually I was on The Mummy, I believe it was. And and at one point Barney called and he was going to do another project that was based on The Norman Mailer book, The Executioner's Song, about Gary Gilmore, who was like the first guy who was executed via the death penalty after the Supreme Court reinstated the legality of the death penalty. And so this Norman Mailer book is all based on that story.
Sure.
He wanted to be killed by firing squad, which was, I guess, an option back then. And
I think you could pick your method of execution, wasn't it,
the deal? I guess. I don't know. I mean, I'd never read the book. Like, right. I couldn't get through it. It was a little too dense for me, kind of dark. But
sure.
But so we started doing this other project, and it was going to be shot on HD. It was going to be 1920 by 1080. It was one of the first like HD projects. The previous project was DigiBeta.
Sure.
And this was going to be full HD. And that project, we started working on it in the same capacity at ILM. I got permission to do it. But there was some, there's some like nudity in it.
Okay.
And some kind of like weird, like there's a bee that comes out of like a, as part of a sex scene that's involved. And it's kind of, it was pretty racy, I guess. And we were making a digital version of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir.
Okay.
So, because it was all set in Utah, which is where this Gary Gilmore story took place. And anyway, so we started working on it, and somebody saw some of the stuff we were working on and kind of got upset about it, and so we couldn't work on it there anymore, and I got in a lot of trouble, which was kind of a bummer, and it was sort of like flying too high or whatever, trying to do too many things without my own resources.
Right.
And so we wound up actually taking that job, and we brought it down here to L.A., and we worked with an old ILM friend of mine, Karen Ansel, who had started her own business here, and she was really good friends with the guys from Nothing Real, and they were just doing the first like beta versions of Shake.
Yes.
And so we used Shake, and Karen was the supervisor. I wound up being the producer, and I let her be the supervisor for the next show because it was her company.
Right.
And then we worked with those guys and did this whole other project, and we worked at the Sony HD Center at, where we did all the transfer and of all the data back and forth, which was really cool. And that turned into another cool project. And after that, I was back at ILM and was about to work on, it was like, I think Space Cowboys was my next show I was scheduled to work on.
That's all the old guys going to space.
Geezers in space.
Yeah.
And
I was thinking Space Cowboys, like not Alien and Cowboys. No, Space Cowboys. Right.
Yeah, I think that's what it was called.
Yeah, it was exactly what it was called.
It had Clint Eastwood.
And
Jim Rockford.
Who's the guy in No Country for Old Men, the sheriff?
Oh, yeah, Tommy Lee Jones.
Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And so I was going to start working on that job, on that show, and Barney called, and they were going to do the final of this Cremaster cycle of five films. They were going to do the final show, and it was going to be all set in New York City. New York was the central focus of the film.
Yep.
They were going to turn the Chrysler Building into a maypole.
Uh-huh.
And they're going to shoot this huge sort of video game-like sequence in the Guggenheim Museum. And he wanted to know if I wanted to come to New York and supervise all the like post-production stuff for the show. And they had a really big budget. And so I quit my job at ILM and moved across the country to New York.
Okay.
Yeah. Which was weird. It was like, I grew up in California. For anybody who's grown up on either coast, moving to the other coast, I always tell them it's like, it is like moving to another country.
Yes.
Like, it's totally different.
I'll tell you what. Driving from Burbank and quote-unquote living downtown for the last few days, it's like I'm in a different country. It is 30 minutes.
Even across town.
It is 30 minutes away, and I might as well be in a different country.
Yeah.
It is insane.
Sure.
Yeah. But I can, definitely East Coast and West Coast people are very different.
Well, I feel like the East Coast is like, it's more like, people always ask you on the East Coast, they say,
where did you go to
where
school?
Are you from?
Right.
Because knowing something about like your family lineage is informative. It's like an old world question.
It's heritage.
Yeah. And here, the first question people ask you in California is, what do you do?
What do you do?
Yeah, because you're what you do here. It doesn't matter. No one's from here, right?
No one's from here. What do you do? Where are you from? And the other thing that they ask on the East Coast is, where did you go to school?
Right.
Yeah, where you got your degree is your pedigree.
Yeah.
And here is, you know, if you're in LA, it's like, you know, what movies have you worked on possibly,
right.
or
yeah,
something
totally.
Like that, right?
Yeah.
You know, that's your pedigree, right?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, it's, you know, true. So it's very different. Like, I think it's also like, you know, I am a lawyer, I am a architect, I am a, you know, investment banker are important. Here it's like, I've got seven different things going on.
Yeah.
Some things are different. So yes, moving.
Some might catch on and some will probably peter out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, the other game I like to play is, you know, walking around Venice is like, homeless or millionaire?
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, that's a good. You can play that game downtown too.
You can play that game downtown.
I think downtown you're probably more likely to like know
the answer. Yeah, but in Venice it was hard to figure out. Like, is that a millionaire or a homeless person?
Yeah, that's good. That's a good one. Like, that's a good game. I should play that next time I go down there.
Because that's the other thing that was also very, you know, like in how you dress and how you present yourself physically in the East Coast is very important.
Well, I realized that's actually kind of funny you say that, because I realized when I moved to New York and I started it, I moved to New York and drove across the country and found an apartment and started working for it with Matthew Barney and doing preliminary sort of pre-production work for this big project. And I realized that almost every other word out of my mouth was like a four-letter word, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And it's sort of the California vernacular. Like, they make a joke about it in Big Lebowski, you know? Like,
yep.
And I do think it's, yeah, it's like, it's so common. Like,
it's like, do you have to use so many curse words? What the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah. It's so true. And, like, I realized in New York that no one spoke that way.
Yeah.
Like, even
unless
people,
unless you're the work different, like, depends on your working class, right?
Yeah.
So that vocabulary sort of determines your hierarchy.
Well, they
as well.
would curse and stuff, but they would never, like, in just, you know, back and
regular
forth
conversation.
Just chit chat. They wouldn't. They were much more articulate.
Yeah, it wasn't. It's not used as a comma as it is in
here. Yes, that's totally true. That was the biggest difference. But I actually thought that, like, the other thing in the East Coast that I thought was really cool is the one thing that would happen is people would yell at you and they would honk their horns and stuff. And I always thought it was kind of healthy in a way, because it was like this, there's so many people in this small space and it was like this valve.
Right.
And it would like let off steam and people could kind of like decompress a tiny bit, like on the subway or honking or, you know, like cursing at you, crossing in front of them.
And what's funny is that if you're not from that area and you hear someone yell at you, you think something's
wrong. You're like, what's wrong?
Because like 5 seconds later, be like, all right, cool, just move on.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah, that's totally true. Those were the biggest differences, I think.
Yeah.
And whereas here, it's like the joke was always like, if somebody honks at you in LA, like, watch out, like shots could be fired at any moment.
Yep.
You know, like things are so like ratcheted up so fast here to like, you know, a totally different level of commitment. But yeah, New York was really cool. Like, I had a great time. We did that whole show, and that project was massive. It was like, we shot in the Guggenheim Museum. We shot in the Chrysler Building. We built huge sets in Sunset Park, Brooklyn.
That's so cool.
A lobby of the Chrysler Building that we got five 1967, four 1967 Chrysler cars and one 1938 Chrysler.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the four Chryslers doing a demolition derby in the lobby of this Chrysler Building set that we built. And it was all practical. We did the whole thing in this space and compressed the 1938 into a tiny little metal denture that went into the mouth of a character in the movie who prolapses their intestines, and their teeth form a porcelain rod under this dental chair. And it's an art movie. It was nuts. But the CG stuff was really fun. And while I was there, I met...
Can anyone find this?
You can find it on the YouTubes.
Okay.
And if you're ever in New York, you
What's
can always...
What's it called again?
It's Cream Master 3.
Cream Master 3. Okay, so we'll put a note of that.
Yeah. Right. There's Cream Masters 1 through 5, and they were made out of order. 4, 1, 5, 2, and then 3.
Okay.
Finishing in the middle.
Yeah.
And, yeah, and there's a whole kind of
logic to the story, I think. I really enjoyed it. It was fun to work on. They're not movies that I would go back and watch over and over again.
Sure.
But they're really interesting as sort of like Americana, like art circa late 90s, you know, pre-9/11 kind of expressions of sort of hubris, you know, things that maybe wouldn't tonally work quite the same way today. But it's fun. It's interesting stuff. And while I was there, I worked at Post Perfect for a little while, where Alex Seiden, who I had worked with at ILM, had moved to New York. And he was working there doing commercials. And I got a job working there with him. And I met this guy, Adam Martinez, there. And Adam Martinez was like a superstar. He was like a young guy. He'd gone to Rutgers. And he...
Is Adam part of... He's one of the VES guys right now, isn't he? No, Adam... Okay, never mind.
Think so. Okay. I haven't talked to him in a while, but he's a brilliant young guy.
Yeah.
Went to Rutgers and did like he was doing stuff in Maya at Post Perfect that was like, you know, so much more sophisticated than anything Post Perfect was trying to do.
Sure.
Or Cyclotron was the company. It was a division of Post Perfect. And he and I sort of started hanging out, and I kept telling him, I said, dude, you should go to California. Like, you could make bank there. Like, you'd be a superstar. Like, they want people like you, you know, like you're doing it, you know. He was just doing it, and he was into it. He really loved it. And he wasn't quite ready to leave, I don't think, but he and I decided, I conned him into sort of leaving the company and coming to work with me. And him started this company in New York, and we got an office in Midtown and all to work on this this Cream Master movie. And so it was me and him and Louis Cataldi and Kevin Ramond. And Kevin Ramond is now like the head water guy at Weta, I think.
Yeah, nice.
But so it was a cool like collection of just like young guys trying to sort of do our own thing. And and that was a super fun project. I met my wife working on that show. She was a carpenter building sets. And we did that, and then we got married, and we went to the Orkney Islands for our honeymoon.
Yeah.
Which I brought Chris some Highland Park.
You did. You brought me an amazing gift. It is so up my alley. You bought me a Highland Park 12, which is incredible. I love Highland
Park.
Which
isn't the fanciest one. It was that or Oban, but Oban was a little pricier. And that one I thought
I actually like Highland Park better than Oban. I do.
Yeah, it's the real peaty, you know. But I haven't, that one, it's like a special one. It's Viking Honor, which, I don't know. I kind of like the Viking vibe. It's cool.
Yeah, well, whiskey is you know, very close to my heart, and that is an excellent whiskey.
And your liver.
I definitely appreciate it. I'm definitely into the liquors that have been aged and turned brown.
yeah, it was fun. It's neat, like that's a cool thing to do if you're into that. Like, is to go to Scotland and tour, like some of the distilleries, like just cruise around. And
definitely,
it's beautiful country too. It's so desolate and like,
you
know, really Spartan.
I was just in Iceland this summer. So
you were.
Yeah,
that's cool. What were you doing there?
Vacationing.
Oh.
Yeah.
And did you drive the ring road and stuff?
Did not drive the ring road. We decided to do a sort of like choose your own adventure. And the ring road is cool, but my wife sort of went on to Google Maps and sort of found an area that was like fairly remote, which is in the West Fjords, which is kind of like the ring road kind of bypasses the West Fjords.
Yeah, it's more in the interior.
Right.
Yeah.
And so she said, you know, like she just kind of zoomed into an area and then did hotel to search in Google Maps and found like one place that you can get. It's like, what if we just went there?
That's awesome.
And yeah, it was pretty remote.
We spent a summer there in 2010, I think.
Oh, okay.
My wife got a residency in Skagastrand, Iceland, this little fishing village.
Nice.
And it was cool. The only thing is, I have to say, food in Iceland, not that good. There were a couple of nice restaurants
in Reykjavik. Depends on what you get. Well, right now, the food is I mean, you went in 2010, which is 2 years after the crash. So I'm assuming it was a little bit more affordable.
Maybe. Yeah.
Because right now, Iceland is really insanely expensive.
Yeah.
The food is specifically insanely expensive.
Hmm.
When you're talking about food, pretty much your choices are like, if you like fish or lamb, you're set.
Yeah.
You know, but their fish soup that they have there.
Yeah.
Delicious.
Yeah.
I cannot get enough of
did
that.
Did you eat
soup.
The pickled shark?
I didn't do the pickled shark. I did not eat puffin or whale either.
Yeah.
Which, here's an interesting thing about Iceland. I found out that there's a misconception that whale is actually a tradition in Iceland. It's not. They've only been fishing whale for the last 70 years.
Yeah.
And apparently 95% of the whale consumed in Iceland is tourists. That most Icelandic people don't eat whale. They do. It's not part of their diet. They don't eat it. It's not anything they do.
It seems so like kind of even grosser than like you would think.
It is.
Like
it's it
like,
is. Huh. Basically, they
like
fish
some forbidden fruit.
Yeah. So basically, and it's American tourists like, well, I guess I'm going to try whale because that's a tradition in Iceland, but it's not.
It's
sold as a tradition, which it isn't, specifically to get people to just try it or whatever. And it's a tourist trap, really. And the same with puffin.
Serve them like chicken or Icelandic horse or something. No one would know the difference.
So many horses too.
Yeah, there's a lot of horses.
Yeah, I think that's the problem in Iceland is that the like beef is very, very expensive there because they don't have beef, but yet all the Americans want a burger, and that's really expensive. It's like $25, $30 for a burger.
We just got to do the lab burgers, you know, the lab meat.
Lamb is huge there. Anyway, off of Iceland, let's go back to some of your career. You ended up in the education field. How did that happen?
Well, yes. So, like, I met my wife in New York, and we eventually we traveled some. We went to Japan for a Matthew Barney project, and with Bjork. So I got to work with Bjork and Matthew Barney in Japan on the big. They did. Which, speaking of whaling, it was like where they turn into whales, kind of.
Right.
It's a ridiculous movie, but.
I remember that movie. Yeah,
Drawing Restraint 9.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was the supervisor on it. And me and my company, we did all the visual effects for
it. Oh, awesome.
It was not the greatest visual effects, but it was because we didn't have much money. But we did have a lot of money, but not a lot of money for doing what they wanted to do.
Right.
We got to go to Japan and for like 6 weeks, which was really fun. And traveled around with Bjork and Barney, and then they broke up, and then she made that album that's all about like, kind of what a dick he was, I guess, right? The Vulcanaria album.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But yeah, we went and we did that, and then we went to New Zealand for King Kong, before that we came back to California, and I worked on the Matrix sequels at ESC.
Oh.
I went to Tippett and did Hellboy and Matrix 3.
Yes.
And went back to ESC for Constantine. And we had our son. Our son was born at that time.
Then we went to Japan. You knew John Lynn?
Yeah.
Okay. Stephen Parker?
Yep.
Very close friends with Stephen Parker.
Yeah. Brilliant guy. Super cool dudes to work with.
I just saw John. John and I worked at DD for a long time because we did some digital human stuff and all that other stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that was a cool. ESC was an amazing.
That's what I was going to get at. It was like those guys seemed like they were like, let's figure out. I mean, it was cutting edge.
Yeah.
And almost a little bit too cutting edge, I think.
Yeah. I mean, those movies weren't that hot. That was the one thing I was thinking about, too, is. One of the things while I was working there was, I won't say any names, but there was one person I was working with who was a younger artist, but who had kind of risen up into kind of a semi, not like a lead role, I guess you'd say. And we were talking at lunch one day, and I had just said something about like, well, you know, I don't think these movies are going to be that good, really.
Right.
And
the 2 and 3 movies.
Yeah. And like, yeah. I mean, not that it mattered. Like, they looked pretty goofy to me. I didn't think they were going to be that hot. And this young guy, he got so angry And he was yelling at me at lunch, and he's like, well, why don't you go do something else? Why are you even working here? And I said, well, look, like, I'm a professional. Like, I like my work. I like my job. I like what I do.
Sure.
But, I mean, I don't have to like every movie I work on. I'm not the filmmaker. You know?
Right.
Like, and I always thought that was so strange. Like, I've never quite understood that piece, like, taking... I never felt like a really strong sense of ownership over my work. I think some people do.
I'm 100%. There was someone,
and I think it's okay if you do.
There was someone who, it was a very healthy thing. Someone says, like, you know, one in five projects you work on, you're going to go, that was amazing.
Right.
You know what I mean? So you take the other four, you write them out, and you make the best of them.
Yeah.
Or you say, you know what's good about this movie? Not the movie, but the great team that I worked on.
Totally. It's always, that's the key, I think, is it's the people that you meet, the people
sure.
that you work with, where it's like, I still, to this day, some of my all-time favorite human beings are people that I met working on shows.
Right.
Like, just brilliant people.
I had such a great time working on iRobot. Not a great film.
Yeah.
But the brilliant minds that we worked on to make some really interesting solutions together, and the camaraderie and excitement we got out of it, it was great.
Totally.
You know? And then every now and then you get a movie that you're like, this is going to be a shit film.
And
right?
It's awesome.
And it's awesome. Like, to me, it was real steel. Like, I was looking at the design of the robots. I'm like, this is the stupidest. This is Rock'em Sock'em Robots, and it's stupid.
My son, at the time when we saw it, he loved that movie.
Yeah. I still think it's great. What was weird about it is that, who's the director? Levy? No. Anyway, he really loved the work that we were doing at DD, and he basically arranged for an early screening for us in the screening room, which doesn't happen that often,
That's cool, believe it or not.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Doesn't happen. So we watched a screener. It obviously had a bunch of previews, which we knew because we were doing a lot of visual effects on it.
Sure.
And we were looking at it, and it started off, and I'm like, oh, this movie's not what I thought it was. And then by the end, we were like, you know, all these guys, like, it's like wiping the tears from our eyes. Like,
my robot.
That was a really good movie.
And we're
like, and then like realized, like, oh, this. And then suddenly there's a sense of pride. Now, listen, even if you work on a crappy movie,
yeah,
you're still going to give 100% because
it's your job.
It's your job, and yeah, you want to take pride in what you're putting out
totally.
There.
Totally.
But it doesn't necessarily. I mean, listen, I put 100% into Ghost Rider.
Yeah.
I'll tell you this, and I've never seen the movie.
Yeah, no, there's a few movies I've worked on that I've never seen.
Right.
Sure. I never saw Speed 2 Cruise Control.
Right.
I've never seen Small Soldiers.
Right.
Yeah. A couple others, probably.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. It doesn't. I just always thought it was interesting. Like I like my work, but I don't necessarily have to love every movie I work on.
No, you don't. And if you're an architect, you don't have to love every building you design.
Yeah.
You know, or some clients are more challenging, and then at that point, it's like, okay, well, I'll just give you what you want, and
yeah,
we'll move on.
We'll just compromise, and this job will be over eventually.
Yeah, and that's okay. I mean, that's, you know... what was another expression that my wife used? This is about life in general. It's like, not every day can be awesome.
Yeah, it's totally true. I think that's one of the things I like about, like, it's one of the things I probably miss most about the industry. Like, after the Japan project with Barney and Bjork, we went to New Zealand for like a 9-1-1 thing for King Kong for, I think, like 6 months for the Peter Jackson King Kong. And,
uh-huh.
And that was an amazing time for my wife and my son. They had a blast every day in New Zealand. They were
right.
driving around on the other side of the road, and they treated us great, you know. But I worked on that job, and I'm not proud of this at all. I actually think this was the stupidest thing I've ever done. I worked the last, like, 3 or 4 weeks on that show. I did an average of 110 hours a week. I mean, they were paying a lot of money in overtime, so yeah. I made a lot of money on that show. But I feel like I lost a couple years of my life. Like, I felt so sick and, like, just gross by the end of it. And there were other people doing the same thing. I mean, it felt like that was kind of what was expected to get that show finished.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not a fun experience. And I thought I would never work in the movie business again after that. Like, I was just like, I'm done. Like, mm-hmm. that was cool. I made some dough. So we left New Zealand, and and our son turned two when we were there. And my wife said, hey, can we move back to, we had been in California before we left. And she said, can we move back to Virginia, which is where she grew up, be close to her parents, my in-laws. And they could, you know, sort of help out with the kid and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And I was like, sure, why not? Like, okay. I'll figure out something to do there. Like,
so okay.
So we moved back. We moved to Virginia, and we had a lot of money in the bank that we slowly sent back over to the United States.
Yeah.
And so I think for like about 6 months, I was just kind of like doing odds and ends, like little jobs that came up, freelance stuff. I did like a lighting job for a video game for Call of Duty or something.
Sure.
Just little gigs like that, or some compositing things. And then I read, there used to be that magazine. Do you remember Res magazine?
Yes.
It was like this cool, like little video magazine. It's like now defunct, but I had a copy of Res magazine, and it was like Res Fest, you know, like 2005 or something, and had this, the disc in it with all the like cool weird shorts that people had made, and there was an ad in the back for a teaching position at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia, and we were living in this little farm. We lived on a farm in this town called Keswick, which is just east of Charlottesville, Virginia, which is in the center of the state.
Yeah,
if you look at a map of the state, and Richmond's like, I asked my wife, I said, well, what's, do you know anything about VCU? And she's like, yeah, it's a pretty good state school. You know, it's okay. Right. They have a big art school.
Right.
And how far is it from here? And it's like, oh, it's, you know, it's like an hour. And it's like, huh. And they were looking for somebody to teach 3D computer, like, and they said 3D computer animation to students. And I don't know if they knew exactly how they were, what they were saying when they were describing it. And I'm not an animator, but I was like, but I've animated stuff like everybody. And it's like, I'm not this, but I've done that. You know, like you sort of do it, right?
Sure.
If you have to. And
I take it too literally sometimes.
Yeah, totally.
Right. Yeah.
So I just applied. I sent my reel and like a one page resume or whatever it was, you know, with the credits on it and a cover letter. And they called me up and I went in for an interview. And I've never in a million years ever had any interest in doing anything in academia. Like, that's never been on my radar at all.
Right.
They offered me the job.
Wow.
And based on my professional experience at that point, I had so many movies under my belt and so many different projects I'd managed. And they granted me an equivalency of a master's degree when they hired me. And I started working there, and I was the only person, really one of the only people at the university that was doing anything that was basically applied computer graphics, you know, like using them like off the shelf or even writing some little tools to do certain things. And there was nobody there really doing any of that kind of stuff. And I felt like it was sort of like stepping back in time. Like it was at first it was frustrating because it was, the speed of academia is glacial.
Yes.
You know, like I always feel like, you know, it's one of those things where a friend of mine who's since come to work with me there, he once said, after he'd been there a while, he was in a meeting and he's like, oh, we could try this. We could do this. Why don't we try this? Mm-hmm. And all these other people around the table were like, whoa, hey, slow down there, Turbo. And he was like, look, I don't know if I have a gear that low, you know, to go that slow. And in academia, at least at the time, it can move at a very slow pace. You'll have a meeting.
Right.
6 months later, you get together and you have another meeting, you know, and no one's really done anything. And,
right.
And that can be really frustrating coming from a production environment where, like,
especially in this industry where everything changes every 6 months, right? Well, so the meeting becomes irrelevant.
And it's like reinventing itself. And like everyone's working to solve complex problems and like get things done. And
now
make
it's
things
all
work.
About machine learning and everything else. And that's happening
and it's
so fast.
Exciting and real time rendering and like real time ray tracing and digital humans. And like, I mean, that stuff is so, so exciting. And it's been a long slog. I mean, I love my job now, but when I first started, it was really hard to get used to sort of that shifting gears in that way. And one of the things I've come to really love about teaching, though, is I've now been doing it for 13 years. I went from an assistant professor to an associate professor with tenure after 6 years.
Yeah.
And then I just got this last year. I'm now a full professor. There's no such thing as a full professor unless we go out to eat.
Right.
I eat a lot of food. But I'm a professor. Like, it's the top gig I could have at the school. So,
But you have tenure as well. So
yeah. So, I mean, it's a great gig. And the thing I love is that it's a state school. We have a high percentage of students at our school who are people of color.
Yeah.
We also have a lot of students at the school who are first in their families to go to college, which is really exciting. And the school, it's considered, Virginia Commonwealth University is considered to be the number one public art school in the country. Public art school.
Yes.
It's ranked really high. We have a new dean who is shaking things up there in a pretty exciting way. And a colleague of mine who I worked with at Industrial Light and Magic, Ty Ellingson, who was the visual effects art director on Jurassic Park. He was the lead vehicle designer on Avatar.
Mm-hmm.
He's done a ton of stuff with Guillermo del Toro. He is now works with me in our department, and it's awesome. Like, a lot of our students are interested in drawing.
Yes. So
there's a lot of drawing that goes on in our program.
Nice.
And it's great. I love it. I have a number of students who are actually here at SeaGraph as student volunteers this year, which is really fun.
Nice.
And the one of the things that's come up at SeaGraph this year, which I totally dig, is there's a lot of talk about mentoring.
Yes.
I don't know. Were you at the NVIDIA All-Stars event?
No, I didn't go to that one.
It was cool. They had, like, these three young women got up and talked about their experiences being mentored and now mentoring.
Now mentoring, yeah.
And that's a big thing as a teacher, you know, at a university, is like mentoring.
It's all about
students
mentorship,
and like, you know, engaging with them and trying to sort of spend a lot of time like listening, you know, and trying to understand like what they're about, where they're coming from, and then to help sort of hopefully guide them and show them like a panoply of opportunities of things that they could engage in and pursue. Things that like that didn't exist when I was a student, and things that I probably didn't. I was probably so introverted too when I was that age that it would have been hard for me to hear stuff like that from a teacher. And it's really exciting when I can come to an event like this or another conference elsewhere and have like students who have been in my classroom who said, "Will you write me a letter for for the volunteer program?" And then they come out and they're doing it. And I ran into one of my students today, and I'll see the other couple of students who are here tomorrow, I think, at some point. But and that's been really cool. There's something super rewarding about it. And the teaching, I think, I'm going to turn 50 in February.
Right.
So the big 5-0. And I do feel like sometimes the grind of production, the long hours of production, well, I miss that camaraderie, and I definitely miss the people. I mean, I can't tell you how much I miss the people. Like, I miss the problem solving. Like, I had that excitement of solving complex problems with the big team.
Yeah.
I don't miss the hours. I sometimes miss it paid better. I don't know if it's still
dead. I don't miss production.
Yeah, I don't know if I miss production.
I don't miss production
that much either.
But I get to come here every year and see the same people. And the thing is that I found with my job is that you can do other things with the industry that's beyond working in the movies.
Yeah.
And it's just as rewarding, if not sometimes more rewarding, just like you just explained. You know, like, I love helping people. I love helping people find a way to solve a problem. So, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. And I think that's a cool thing to, like, I got to go to the Amazon Mars conference in Palm Springs in March.
Yep.
And it was just like a guy who worked for Amazon who was help organizing the conference speakers. He listened to the VFX show. It was like, "Oh, it's cool. I mostly agree with you." I'm like, "Oh, so you're
that's pretty easy.
You're a snotty jerk, okay? That's cool. You're a film snob.
I
just don't like everything."
Matt is on another podcast that I actually really enjoy. And honestly speaking, that podcast has been around for a long time. And when I was first thinking about this podcast, I actually listened to a lot of that podcast. And I was thinking about, like, back when the early days, it was it was you and obviously Mike Seymour and Davis Trepenis were the three
right.
people that were involved.
Maybe I did one show with David. I can't remember.
You may have done one, but David is also like the outrageous person.
Yeah.
He liked to be the outrageous person. That was good. It's good to have an outrageous person on a podcast. I think that Mike tried to be the balancing person.
I have to say, Mike Seymour, though, like, I have so much respect for him. Like, he's so brilliant. Like, and he's such a, I've learned a lot, like, over the years now, like, sort of working with him. Like, he's been, I've never told him this, but I mean, he's kind of been a mentor to me in some
really?
Ways.
Really? That's great.
In maybe unofficial capacities. And, like, it's been really great getting to know him more.
I like Mike. I think Mike is very, very interesting. I think he's got some brilliant ideas. I think that he is a very important person to the industry based on all the things he's done, including, you know, his publication for FX Guide, his podcast, be it an, you know, VFX show, which is more long form and more entertaining podcast, or just one of them that's much more journalistic. But they're great, and I think he's really cool. I really did like... I agree with a lot of what you're saying too. I'm with the other guy here. You're just mentioning a story. I actually really agree with it. I also thought that you have a very smooth way of delivering your point of view. I think it's your voice and the way you just make it sound very like you're very convincing. You've got a very convincing voice.
I think I used to be a lot more of like a short fused kind of. Like hotter tempered,
but you've
person.
Been working in academia for 13 years. Maybe that's.
And I've gotten older, and like I think a lot of the things that like, you know, a lot of my motivations when I was younger were like, I wanted to like you know meet girls or something, you know, like really. I mean, it was like really simplistic kind of young man mindset, and I think you know. I think getting married and being a dad and like teaching and stuff, it kind of slows your brain down. And I kind of like not having, as I get older, I like not having all those kind of like more youthful or purient concerns, you know, already. Like it's kind of, like some people I always lament about, like, oh, I hate getting old, like I'm so sore now and I'm tired all the time or whatever people say, but I kind of dig it. I'm kind of into it. I kind of feel more like I'm a, like as you get older, I feel like I become a better version of the sort of crazy, obsessive, compulsive young person that I was. You know,
I'm going to agree with you.
Yeah,
I'm going to agree with you, and I'm not. And that's not to say that these young guys like are not the old man shaking the fist at the young guys.
Oh, no, not at all.
Not at all. It's just, I think actually that's a really great perspective of being old and still respecting people that are energetic and stuff. You know?
Oh, totally. I mean, that's the thing that's so funny is I'm going to these talks now at SeaGraph this week, and like every single talk I go to that people are saying, I think I said earlier, I don't know if we were recording, but the thing of like, you know,
I was inspired by
a Harry Potter movie like, to get into visual effects, and now this young woman is like, you know, the executive vice head of production at whatever, you know, and she's like, and I'm thinking like, I mean, you were inspired to get into this by Harry Potter, and it's like, I don't think I was even in the industry really anymore when Harry Potter was. I don't even know, but like, it's like one of those things where it kind of, that's really fascinating. And realizing that so many of these people who are getting up and giving these amazing talks and amazing presentations, they're, you know, in their 20s and 30s and stuff, and they're just like, they're crushing it. Like, and they're working with a whole new paradigm, a whole new set of tools and of, you know, artistry and of shot counts in shows and stuff. I mean, the explosion of the kinds of things that you can do now as opposed to even, you know, even 10 years ago.
Right.
Or, you know, 15 years ago. I mean, it's pretty remarkable.
Yes, absolutely. It's a different world. And that's fine. I like it. In fact, I feel like I'm a part of that world, but in a different from a different point of view, and I like being like We were talking about yesterday the difference between a camera ray and a photon ray that comes from the opposite direction. I'm like a photon ray. I'm coming from the opposite direction.
That's awesome. That's so
you know
good.
What I'm saying? It's like everyone's looking this way. I'm like, I'm coming from this side, and I'm going to meet you halfway. You know? So I feel a little bit like that way, and that's fun, you know?
Yeah.
But are you going to go to Light or Darker tonight?
I am.
Okay, me too. I got to figure out where it is. I got to look up the address.
Yeah, I've got it somewhere here. I've got to figure out how I'm going to get there.
I'm going to rely on an app on my phone called Uber.
Yeah, like I should probably, you know, this is kind of embarrassing, but where I live, like, you know, I've never taken, I live like 5 miles from work.
Right.
So I can ride my bike or take the bus.
Yeah.
And we have one car. We're a one car family.
Yeah.
And I'll sometimes get a ride.
Right.
But like, I've never taken a ride sharing car service before.
I took one to go a mile and a half the other day. That's embarrassing because I didn't even know how far it was. I just assumed I was going to get an Uber, and it was like, oh.
The craziest thing are like these scooters and these like weird bikes that are all over the city. Like
very popular.
Yeah. That looks dangerous.
They're a little bit dangerous. We can get into that later because they're mostly being used not to actually make profit on you riding them. They're mostly used to steal your data.
That's what it seems like. It does feel like it's like a weird, seedy, like phishing scheme.
Yep. They want to know who you are, where you're going, and what your interests are,
and all the contacts on your phone.
Yeah, they're not actually stealing that, but it's mostly about like
they feel dirty. When
they make more money giving your data away than they do from you riding it and paying $2 to ride the scooter.
Right.
All right. Well, listen, that's a depressing note to end on. But nonetheless, Matt, I really appreciate you coming on. I'm so glad you got, we've been in touch with each other for years in email, and we've never actually met in person. And I was so glad you were able to get in touch with me and say, hey, I'm going to be in LA. Let's get together. And I was like, the first thing I thought, I was like, I need you on this podcast.
Thanks so much for having me on. I've listened to this. I was telling you earlier, I've listened to so many of these, and it's fun. It's like, I think one of the things that you maybe don't recognize just because you're doing it, I do think that the repository of interviews that you've done now, there's, how many have you done now? A couple hundred?
235.
Yeah.
So like, far today.
It's an archive. It's a historical record that I think has a lot of value. Like the only thing I would say, and we should talk about this later,
is that
there's two worlds. And I have to say, I feel like the world that is largely the world that I hear on your show is not a world that like I had much contact with.
Which is what?
There's like a Southern California world and a Northern California world. And there's so little Northern California world on your show.
Okay.
So not that that's bad. It's just really different. Like there's a lot of Sony. There's a lot of DD.
Yeah, that's
and the
that's
stories and histories of DD, which because that's your background.
Right.
But there's not much ILM.
I need more ILM.
And
okay,
maybe I can hook you up with some.
Well, then I need to spend more time
characters.
up in Northern California.
Or get people. They're always down here too.
Could be. Okay. Well, Matt, I'm gonna. Well.
I mean, for what it's worth, I mean, it's just my, as a listener.
I've had Spaz Williams on, so that was
good. That's true.
No, it's true.
He's Canadian.
Oh, my God.
He is Canadian bacon.
He is insane. I mean, he's almost like a parody of a Canadian person.
Yeah.
He's sort of a caricature.
Yeah. Spaz. Spaz is a caricature.
How people say, Canadians say A all the time? They never do. Except when you meet Spaz and he does say A all the time.
Yeah.
He's a wonderful person.
He's a really great guy, yeah.
He's a wonderful person. And he, every now and then, after that podcast, he actually had such a great time on the podcast that he and I have become great friends. And he calls me up every now and then and just like pours his heart out with some ideas. Like, I've got some ideas. And
it's cool. There's some really interesting, kind of tangential but luminary characters that might be fun for you to talk to.
I want to get a lot of people on I would love to get a lot of people up from ILM. it may be worth me going up to that area and spending.
Well, but some of them too, I think that would be really interesting maybe too, would be ones who like have left, you know, like they were there and now they're off doing something else, but they would have some interesting historical perspective.
Okay.
Too, that, well, I mean, just if that sounds interesting to you.
It does sound interesting to me. So we will brainstorm on this. We will definitely brainstorm on that. And I appreciate the feedback. That's a good idea.
I'm sorry. It's like, that's the compositor, right? The compositor has to come in and be super anal retentive and like offer like some sort of opinion.
Yes. So you know, what's wrong with my lighting?
Yeah. It's just my nature.
Next thing is like, you know what you really need? You don't have any interviews from the other side of the equator. You need more Weta interviews. So I'll get Dan Lemon on or something. All right. Well, thanks so much, Matt. I really appreciate you being on. And, you know, anytime you're in town, let me know and we'll get together again.
Cool.
That sounds great.
We'll drink some scotch.
Yes.